You're listening to Sci-Fi for Me Radio.
Gotham can be a lonely place, but Sci-Fi for Chicks wants you to know that's not true in this episode. At least I've got my friends.
I'm dreaming, right?
Oh, I hope so, lady. I sure hope so.
Oh, hell. What's up with them? What are they waiting for?
First man that comes at a new girl nearly always gets jumped by the second man.
Is that right? Here's a promise, boys. The first of you to come at me will die like that. The second will die slow. So, boys, who's first?
Hey everyone, welcome to Sci-Fi for Chicks. My name is Heather, and I'm joined, of course, by my partner in podcasting crime, Alex. Hey, Alex.
Hello, everybody.
I was actually about to introduce you like our other podcaster. Oh, no, wait, we got them in this one. Go back to the other one. That'll be our technical flub for this episode. We're here to talk about Gotham Season 1, Episode 15, Scarecrow, which is the second half of a two-parter that, Alex, it didn't really feel like it was a two-parter. It felt like two separate episodes that just happened to have a thread.
Yeah. You know how last week we hoped that maybe this is like the reverse Gruber storyline, and instead of anticlimactic thing, we're going to be so amazed and so impressed with the second episode. Well, it was better, but still nothing to write home about.
No, it really, really wasn't. See, look, we're already sounding not so friendly about this episode. And here we're calling it, At Least I've Got My Friends. It doesn't seem on the surface to be very much about a friend episode, but there were definitely pairings throughout the entire episode. We did have a few friendly omissions. The first two, I don't think we're actually that upset about, because we keep talking about we'd rather they not be there than have a stupid little story. Yet again, there is no Montoya. Yet again, there is no Barbara in a meaningful way.
Yeah, I think I'm going to start referring to them as our disappearing lesbians, even though technically I know Barbara is bisexual, but it has a ring to it, you know, and they keep disappearing. They had something of a pointless plot at some point, and now they're gone, and, you know, to never be heard from again, possibly. I don't know. It's like Montoya, Allen, and Barbara were those characters that the writers really, really wanted to get and write. And then they kind of decided, yeah, we think we have too many characters.
So let's keep adding more.
Don't we need? Yeah. And let's just disappear the lesbians. Nobody's going to notice. Yeah.
We notice. We notice.
Yeah, we notice.
We want to reiterate again, we really like the actresses. We really like the setup for the characters. There has just been so little payoff.
Yeah. Hey, and I love what both of them do with the material they're given. Because both Victoria Cartagena and Erin Richards are incredible. And when they had something to play with, something to do, they were amazing, and I loved them. And there is a chance that I will stalk them on IMDb and see other things that they were in when I am, you know, not watching a million TV shows a day. But I am not missing their characters. No. And that's the worst thing. What annoys me the most. I should be missing them.
Exactly.
Like Kat. I miss Kat, even though she technically had a reason to not be in the episode. Because she broke up with Bruce.
With her canoeing. The canoe lost a paddle. But like we've said before, it makes sense. They've told us why Kat is disappearing out of the story. I have no reason. Barbara's off sulking that's the entire reason she's gone, is she's off sulking and she's stuck with her obviously very not welcoming and loving parents. And that's the whole reason she's gone. And then we have zero reason for Montoya and Alan to not be there. Zero explanation why the major crimes unit is not here when major crimes are happening. I don't get it.
Yeah. It's like Gotham wants us to forget the stuff that annoys us. Like, don't pay attention to the characters behind the curtain. Yeah. Like, they're not there. But the thing is, you have to give us something to distract us with. To make us forget that there are characters we care about. There and there. And Gotham, it's been a little hit and miss. Yeah. Really.
Definitely. So. And we both keep talking about how we want to see these characters and we want to see them do good. But if they're not going to be there, at least they're not giving them a stupid storyline or a stupid way to stick them in. So
yeah,
there I guess, is the bright side of these missing friends. Mm-hmm. The other friend that we're missing, which I'm hoping we're going to get a good payoff here in the next few episodes, because we love him. And that is Mr. at the Drew Powell Butch. We're missing our Butch.
Oh yeah. My precious little baby.
Our precious baby.
Every time I don't see, our precious little baby. Share. Every time I don't see him on the screen, I am terrified that he is being tortured by Victor's ass or, I don't know, is dead, which is even worse. Case scenario, which, you know, I live in denial. That will not happen. That will not happen. Butch is safe in my shiny happy place with Jesse and Hottie Mark Hotstud. And I love him and I don't want anything to happen to him. So I miss him. I miss him terribly. Which, can we talk about fish? And can I rant?
Sure. When have I ever been able to stop you? I appreciate you asking, but when could I stop you even if I said no?
Well, you can't stop me because have you seen Fish and her Butch substitute? Like, he's terrible. I hate him. I will not like him. I want Butch back.
Give Kelly a break. He's just...
No! Technically, I know intellectually that it's not his fault that he is not as awesome as Butch. I know him. I know that it's not his fault, but I don't care. I want Butch back, and I want this terrible imitation of Butch to go away, die horrible, painful death.
No, we don't want...
Because he is taking screen time from Butch and from Fish and her quest to save Butch.
Okay, well, but she's still on that quest, and maybe he's helping her. He actually does kind of help. He keeps her from jumping in too soon because we know how Fish sometimes when she reacts before she thinks. So he did stop her there. So maybe he is the scab, like Butch is on strike and here we have the guy that'll actually cross the line and be there. But I appreciate the fact that she did have some of that support there because I noticed, did you see how small she looked when we first see her? She is just like totally in this teeny tiny little ball. And it's interacting with him that you start seeing Fish come back out. And when, what is it? They come in and, oh, and those two guys come over and he clues her in about what that is. And if he hadn't told her, I think she would have been caught off guard. Not that anything terrible would have happened, but I think she would have been caught off guard and not been ready to be on top of the game. I think Kelly giving her that heads up that these two guys, this is what they intend to do. You know, the first guy's going to go for you and the second guy's going to jump that guy to get to you as well. You know, new girl in town. Watching her go from this teeny tiny little ball and like, oh, is that right? And then she just stands up tall and proud and Fish was back. At that moment, when I just saw her, I'm like, okay, she's ready to plan, to scheme. That's what she needs, is that she needs that Butch figure there. We want Butch back. I don't want Kelly to take his place, but I think she needs that other, that counterpart for her to really have that confidence to go, okay, I'm Fish. I got this.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think that she would get this confidence and she would get back in play, even without the terrible Butch impersonator. But I think it would take him, take her longer. Cause, when she was sitting in that little tiny ball, making herself least threatening as possible, you know, do not notice me, I am not here, kind of way. Even when she looked small and weak, I didn't see any fear in her eyes. This was Fish assessing the situation. She didn't know where she was. She didn't know what happened. She didn't know who those people were. So she needed to gather information, and that's what Kelly provided, intel. So that she could play the game she's supposed to play. To, you know, go back to our biggest problem with Fish and her scheming in the past. She needed information so she knew what to do, who to talk to, and how to behave. Once she knew what those two guys were planning, she knew what she needed to do to put them in their place, which is, you know, at the bottom, preferably kissing her feet.
I have to say, I think that's a really good point you make, that, you know, it's not so much giving her the confidence or anything, but helping her. She realized that she was playing the wrong game back in Gotham, and she realized it too late. And it looked like she was just like, I'm going to make myself as small as possible so I'm not drawing attention, so I can assess the situation. But when those two guys came up, Kelly's the one that did say, here's the game. This is what the game is. Here are the rules. And she's like, okay, I got it now. I got the rules and I'm ready to play.
And she did, yeah. And she did the same thing when she took down the dog or whoever he was. First, what she did was, you know, tell him that she has skills he could use. And then she learned why he was the one in charge.
Did you notice when she first went up to him and, you know, she got in and she's talking with him, his character's name was Mace, but I do like that she disarmed it because Mace is very threatening sounding. You know, if you have a mace, that's a medieval torture instrument, all this kind of stuff. Yeah. But she gives him Doc, which she goes in this whole, you know, thoughtful and in charge and all this. It's like, no, Doc is a wise dwarf that is hanging out with Happy. Doc is not threatening. Doc, she was putting him in his place. But did you notice at the beginning when he was sitting down and she's standing over him, he couldn't look at her. Like initially he, it's like her gaze was so intense. He couldn't look at her until she came down to his level and started challenging him. And he went, oh, okay. I got it. Honey, you come right here and sit down with me. It wasn't until he thought he had the upper hand on her that he could look her in the eye. And that was actually his undoing. Shiv, we got a Shiv. Never underestimate a Fish.
Yeah, mostly I liked that power play because it was basically David versus Goliath, with Fish as Goliath, because she had all this crime family experience, this ruthlessness, this, you know, brain behind, you know, all the schemes. And there was this guy whose only reason why he was in charge was that he had a weapon.
Exactly.
Like, that was it. He didn't get in charge because he knew how to play the game. He got in charge because he could slash your throat.
Underestimation of her as well, which this, if the episode had been more about her and not about some of the other stuff, I think I might have gone with, you know, the firework title, because I like when him saying, well, you're a firecracker. And she comes back with how a firecracker goes off once and then just lies there. Honey, I'm the 4th of July. And it's like, I love it because she's telling him right there. This, I'm going to explode in your face. This is not going to be good. I mean, he's telling her she's got so much more and he doesn't see it. He just sees, ooh, baby, you know, come here, sit on Papa's lap, you know, and her you know, taking him down and just doing that. My name is Fish Mooney. I'm in charge now. Like, Fish is back and everybody in Gotham better watch out.
Here's my dilemma. On one hand, I cannot wait for her to come back to Gotham and, you know, win it over. Because it's going to be years before Penguin is the villain that we, you know, see against Batman. So she still has time to take over and rule Gotham with her perfectly manicured fist. But at the same time, I kind of want to see her in that separate plot to see what's going on with that woman who lost her eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, because I have a feeling, even though I have no spoilers regarding that subplot, it's going to be creepy and really good.
Oh, yeah.
Unless, of course, Gotham writers screw it up. But it has
Not
all
possible.
The potential to be an incredible subplot.
Mm.
So I kind of want her to stay there and, I don't know, be a part of that mysterious, creepy storyline for a little bit longer, even though, you know, she has to come back to Gotham and save Butch.
Well, we know that Gotham writers, have a propensity for setting up something that could be a nice long arc and then quickly resolving it. I agree with you. I think she needs to stay there for a while, mainly because I don't think she knows where she's at. And she's, even though she's now at the top of the totem pole, she's put herself there and she's showing her power. And there's a lot of people that are down there. So she's going to have her own organization to come back to. These aren't, you know, like when she got on the outs with Falcone, how all of her people left her but Butch. It was just the two of her. She's now building up her own empire again. She's still within those walls.
Mm.
She's still got to get on the other side. And we have to deal with, like you said, the woman that said, they took my eyes. Why are they taking their eyes? And what are they all down there for? So I think she's got a big subplot to stay there. I'd actually rather she stay there longer and maybe we find out about Butch in another way.
That could be good.
I'd actually like to see Butch and Fish separated for a while now. I want to see Butch, and I don't want anything to happen to him. We know that. Check out our tweets. You'll see how much we love Butch and Donnie. I'm going to go ahead and get my little Orphan Black plug in there. We love them, but I think it'd be actually kind of good to have them separate for a while and kind of go on their own story. So it's not just so much her relying on him and him only being there for her. I'd like to see them separate for a little bit.
I could get behind that. And while we hope for, you know, the best and Butch alive and safe and relatively unharmed, I'm also wondering, this is something that, unfortunately, our lack of knowledge regarding comics is a huge drawback, because I keep wondering whether or not the place where Fish ends up, this thing, place, torture, chamber, whatever, is something that appeared in the comics before or not. Because if it is, then the writers might be taking inspiration from a plot from the comics, in a way, so they would have a ready recipe, you know, for great storyline, and they wouldn't have to, like, work too hard. But if it's something original, then I would worry a little more that they could, you know, waste the potential.
I'm hoping they're not going to waste the story. Butch, either potential or life force-wise. What do you know out there, listeners? Let us know, because like we say, we are not in this whole DC universe thing, knowing every little in and out. Are we being all original here with this stuff with Fish, or are we seeing elements from past stories? Let us know. I'm going to go ahead and get this in now. At sci-fi4chicks@sci-fi4me.com. That's our email. Of course, Twitter at sci-fi4chicks and the hotline 573-427-2434. That's 57342 sci-fi. I dare you to try and spoil us. I keep daring them to call us and let us know. Please call us. We're sitting by the phone on a Saturday night, all alone, waiting for you to call. No, we're not, but you know, it's a good... We're like fish. We're not waiting for them.
Hey, if it makes them feel better, go with it. We could be, totally. We are barely sleeping waiting yeah, sure. for a call.
Somebody who is not waiting right. around at all. And I'm loving it because my first baddie of the season, who was only getting first baddie because he was never going to be a baddie again, he's just getting deliciously wonderful. And that is Falcone. Let's head back to Gotham now from wherever we were in Fish's world. Falcone making his entrance into that club with Penguin. He just seems so cold, so calculating, so not sharing anything with anyone. He is, oh my gosh, he was just so fabulously, deliciously scary to me in this episode.
I have to tie it to Penguin a little bit, but remember how we always rant and get frustrated with how mm-hmm. Penguin goes one step forward, two steps back? What happened in this episode was both Falcone and Maroni.
Falcone. Hashtag Falcone.
Push Falcone. Yes. Our new platonic evil gangster
friends.
OTP.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Frenemies. BFFs. but I loved it how the two of them, it's basically this episode, Penguin didn't take two steps back. He was pushed yeah. back.
He was pushed down.
By both Falcone and Maroni. And it was like they knocked him not a peg, like an entire yeah. ladder. It was like, okay, Penguin, you've been useful to us, but you have a tendency to double-cross people. So now that everything's resolved between us, let us show you where your place is. And they did it in such a manner that it wasn't, okay, apparently we can't kill you because you refuse to die.
It's like a cat. He's not like a penguin, he's a cat. He's got nine lives.
Instead, yeah, but instead they killed him socially and they killed his morale because Falcone refused to keep him as his confidant. And Maroni went and kind of showed Penguin how inconsequential, how unimportant Penguin is. Just by gloating and telling him, wow, what a turnout. Because yeah. you could see the crowds in the, you know, Penguin Oswalds.
Not Fishes anymore, it's Oswalds.
Not Fish Moonies, Oswalds. Yeah, so I loved how subtle they were in their social and psychological and assassination of Penguin. And I loved how they went back to scheming together and sharing yeah. a judge.
Well, yeah, to go back to Falcone first, I mean, I love how what happened with Liza. You can tell this has deeply affected him and changed how he's looking at everything. And he was ready to retire. He was ready to give it up. Everybody's trying for my job. I don't need this anymore. And now he's got this fire in him, but it is just so cold. It is just so business, you know, like when he's talking with him about Penguin, about the club, it's like, you're going to clean this place up. It reeks of fish. He wants her gone. He wants everything gone. But then you see him with Maroni. And you can tell, it's not Penguin's here with me because I want him. He's like, yeah, I need him for now. And so I need you to back off for now. And here's what we're going to do so that you'll back off. Because Maroni's all obvious fire. he is just emotion and rage. He is just ready to take this guy mm-hmm. out. And, you know, we're friends, right? And I love when he says, he goes, you know, a sandwich and a stroll won't keep me from killing Penguin. And Falcone's like, so be it. But then he's like, but let me tell you why. Here's why I don't want you to kill him right now. And then, yeah, going to that judge thing. I'm not going to kill the judge for you. I got something even better. And the look on Maroney's face. I mean, Maroney is just exuding this like a kid on Christmas morning. And Falcone is just so all business and cold. And I want to know what's going on in his head because there's fireworks going on in his head. He's just not showing a lick of them. Not one bit. And you're right. I love when I think Penguin still feels safe with Falcone, but he's, of course, on pins and needles, you know, with him. But I think he's like, okay, you know, Falcone says he's going to have my back, so he's going to have my back. When Maroney comes in and starts all that taunting and things, and he starts pouring that expensive champagne, I love the look on Penguin's face. I love how he acted. And I have to admit, I like the shot where the champagne is falling on the floor, looking like Penguin is peeing his pants, that he is just that scared. Yeah. That whole thing, you know, that, you know, you better hope that Falcone lives a really long time. I mean, he tells him, all is kosher between us as long as you don't go giving Falcone any of my secrets. And I hope that Falcone lives a long life because the second he's out of the picture, so are you. Pee. Awesome. I mean.
It was amazing. I also want to see the part where, well, because it was another thing I was asking myself, whether the empty club was because nobody cared and nobody wanted to be at Oswald's, no matter the amount of invites Penguin sent out, or were they warned not to attend?
I think more the second.
Because Penguin has to produce the cash. Falcone told him they need to start making money. Penguin needs to start making money.
That's so, how he's valuable.
In a way, as long as he's making money, he's valuable. But if he's not, what's to stop Falcone from letting Maroney kill him? Because, well, apparently I thought I needed him. Well, clearly that's not the case. So here, have him.
I think Falcone, it's part of Falcone's plan. I mean, he even tells, I mean, he's telling everybody everything that he needs them to know, including like when he says that Penguin is clever enough to know that a freakish little man like him will never be boss. I think Falcone's eyes are open and he knows that Penguin is going to be in debt, but he laid down that thing, like you said, where I need you at this club to make money and you're in charge of this club, so you need to do it. I think actually Falcone is the one that kept people away to put more of that fear into Penguin, that Penguin now knows his life is tied to this because he's no longer valuable as the snitch at all. He can do no more snitching, you know? So if this isn't a success, he doesn't have that protection. Maroney's now put that, you know, whole thing on him. He's put the hammer down that if you're not valuable to Falcone, I'm taking you out. But right now you're valuable to Falcone, so I'll let it go. But he's not producing. So I think we're going to start really seeing this in Penguin. I just have to say, I'm really, probably one of the biggest surprises that I'm really happy about in Gotham and its writing is the fact that these crime bosses, these dons, who I thought were going to literally just be an aside to the story, are really becoming these incredibly well fleshed out characters, incredibly important to the story. I think that is a smart move to really let this real life crime type stuff be a major focus and to get these two actors together that really embody kind of two stereotypes of the dons, you know, the older, more cold, calculating or fatherly type. And then one that's more that Tony Soprano kind of, you know, and we've got the Godfather and Tony Soprano basically here. And they're both playing it so well that I'm not thinking, oh, you're imitating Marlon Brando. Oh, you're imitating James Gandolfini kind of thing. You're your own characters, but you're doing fabulous and you're overshadowing Penguin, one of the great supervillains in Batman. And that's, I think that's what we need, because all of these supervillains, they need something to come out from under to become supervillains, not just villains, but supervillains. And, Falcone is definitely giving them a high bar that they're going to have to surpass. And I think Fish will too. I think we've set it up now where Fish is going to again have one of those crime boss bars that these supervillains are going to just have to go crashing through to make any kind of real presence. So, you know, applause for Falcone. We're not mashing you together because, you know, it's total praise that, you know, you two deserve your own little.
The two of them are amazing. Here's a thought before we move on to other characters. At first, when I thought that people might have been warned off from Penguin's club, I thought it would be by Moroni. Because, you know, he has to put Penguin in his place as well. But when you suggested that it might have been Falcone, I think that would be an incredible twist on everything. Because, in a way, that also makes sense. I mean, Penguin is one of those few people, very few people, who saw Falcone at his weakest.
Mm-hmm.
They saw his weakness in Liza. And now that he's so cold and collected and you know, being this, I'm back, king of the city, I think it would be a way for him to punish Penguin for his part in the whole Liza thing. And it would be spectacular if they went that way.
And
I gotta say, your idea is brilliant. I really hope that's where that would go.
What was that you said again? What did you just say? I'm sorry, I didn't get that last part.
That it's time for us to move on to Jim Bullock. Well,
I have one last little thing there when it comes to Penguin. I do think that we have, you know, it's that friendship between Falcone that Penguin is now going to be underestimating, and they're going to be working together even though they're separate. We have the moment when Penguin decides that he's going to deliver his invite personally to Jim, and we have our little moment there with Ed, our future Riddler. And I have to say that is probably one of my favorite Ed Nigma scenes, so much so that I actually said Nigma, which, you know, I hate saying that. So I thought that was a wonderful kind of cat and mouse between Riddler and Penguin, you know, as they're going around and he comes up to him and I know who you are. Then, you know, you're standing too close, you know, just seeing these two really meet for the first time. I thought it was a really clever way to introduce these two characters to each other. I liked it.
Yes, but here's the thing. In the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of this episode, that particular scene between Penguin and Ed was absolutely pointless. It didn't bring anything to the plot, any of the plots that were happening in the episode. The only reason why it was written, why it had any appeal to fans, was because of their future identities.
I think it's okay to have those winks every once in a while. I mean, it's not like this is the only time that Ed appeared in the episode. He was
in a few other places. I know, but that's not my reason why I'm saying this. That was my disclaimer, that this scene was completely, absolutely pointless. But if you're going to write a pointless scene, this is a scene that's worth writing.
Right.
And not, say, Barbara moving in with her parents.
Let's not go back there.
Another pointless scene. But do you see the difference between pointless scenes, ones that are appreciated by fans? Because that was like you said, a brilliant scene. I was watching it and I was giggling. Like, I couldn't contain myself with glee. I loved it so much. But it was pointless. If you look at it from, you know, logical standpoint, if you cut it out, the episode stays the same. So it was pointless, but it was brilliant. And this is how they should write those scenes.
But it's better with it in because you got a little wink. You know, something that we always like in Sleepy Hollow is they still have those little winks to Crane being out of time. And just this little funny things because it seems right to have, you're not always super serious. So it's fun to have that wink. And it's kind of nice that we're having that little wink out to the audience. That was for us, like you said, that was for the fans. So it was just such a fun little moment. And Ed is starting to endear himself to me a little bit. Not too much. Just, you know.
He's still a creepy creeper that creeps. But now he's adorable.
Exactly.
At the same
time. He's creeping kind of cute.
Which is disturbing.
I'm liking that. Moving on to with Penguin. Here we have our old friend again with Jim. And Jim is just, he's really trying to shed that stank of having a criminal help him solve that case.
Oh, yeah. That scene where with that cop on his knees really shook him. And he's just, no, I am not going there. I am not going to be this person. So whatever Penguin wants from him, even if it's just attending a club opening, nope, not going there. You know, go away. I want nothing to do with you. We are not friends. We were never friends. We will never be friends. Go away. Cop must do cop stuff.
Yeah.
Must do cop stuff. It was brilliantly acted on Ben McKenzie's side. This quiet freak out that no, we have nothing in common. We are not friends. I really liked
the Penguin side of it because I did like what he said. And I think, you know, it is kind of indicative of what Jim went through that isn't it better to be walking with a friend in the dark or no, walking with a friend in the dark is better than walking alone in the light. And that's what Jim was doing at the beginning of the whole season is he was walking alone in the light. And now you've got people around you, you know, that you've got cops that are with you and you've got other people that are with you. It's kind of shedding, I think, a little bit of light on his friends in the dark. And, I thought it was a nice moment. I like that it ended though. Jim thinks it's done, but I think Pengy still thinks that there's this old friend there.
If you want to look at it that way, it's completely unrequited crush on Penguin's side. It's very much Enigma, Miss Kringle kind of thing, where Penguin wants to be friends, and Jim's like, nope, thank you very much, go away.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody that Jim does not want to have go away, though, is our doctor, Lee Tompkins. What did you make of these scenes with Dr. Lee?
Okay, so I am on the record in our past podcast saying that their relationship was rushed and I didn't really like it and I could do without it. But she was amazing in this episode.
Oh, it's Morena.
I really enjoyed, in contrast to other episodes they were both in, I really enjoyed their dynamic here. I couldn't help myself because she was brilliant. He was this, you know, stern, we mustn't kiss at work, and he had all those rules. And Lee was like, sure, honey, of course. And then she went doing her own thing the way she wanted. It was so brilliant. I love
something they did that I think was really great was, again, these throwaway lines that can make such a big difference. At the beginning, we see them on a date with a little snow falling. It was very sweet. They say it's our third date. So we've had a time passage. They've been together. This isn't like immediately after the last episode, last time that we saw them. We now know that they've started building a history that we haven't seen every little thing, that we've moved on to, you know, need to come up to the apartment and, you know, would you like the kitchen? Would you like the living room? The bedroom I think you'd like. But not tonight. So we're having boundaries. We know we're getting closer, but we still have those boundaries. And we've established a time. So yay, See, it didn't take long, writers, to put that in and give us a whole context about where they've moved. Learn from yourselves. Yeah. How did you like, though, Jim's reaction when she says, oh, I start my new job tomorrow as, you know, medical examiner? And he's like, what? What? Even though he's the one that did suggest it.
I liked how real it was. Because this is something we've discussed in the past in our other podcasts. There's a difference between the idea of a woman, of how your relationship could look like, and the reality. Because in theory, Jim really liked the idea of Lee working there, being the medical examiner, and being able to see her every day, you know, at work, and having this relationship develop with those, well, you know, situations and meetings. But then he's faced with the reality, like, oh my God, she's going to work where I work. I'm going to see her every day, and people are going to see us together every day. And he had this very male, very, very guy, like, freak out, like, oh my God, what's going on? Like, no, of course, Lee, I'm fine with you working there. I suggested it, right? So I'm completely fine. But there was a freak out, and at that point, I knew that their scenes in this episode are going to be hilarious, and I'm going to love it. Because that was...
Ben McKenzie is playing them so uncomfortable. Like, when he plays this, his lips and the way he looks, and is like, he's just so uncomfortable with this. Like, I'm sorry, I'm laughing because it's so cute, because you're just so uncomfortable with all of this publicness and you know, Bullock is just such a relaxed kind of a guy, and Lee is just kind of like, well, you know, people show their emotions, you know, in public. They show affection in public. What's wrong with this? It's not unprofessional to show your feelings. And it's just making Jim more and more, like, crazy. It's like, I'm so uncomfortable, but I'm not supposed to be uncomfortable, but I'm uncomfortable.
But so those layers are just adding to everything, because we've seen Ben McKenzie show, you know, righteous indignation, one of my favorite Gordon emotions. We've seen him smooth and, you know, having game, because he managed to be smooth. We've seen him comfortable. We've seen him angry. But this awkward, kind of not wanting to show how awkward he feels, and this tension, it's so hilarious, because it's so natural, the way he plays it, that it just adds to everything. And with every episode of Gotham, even though I rant and complain about what the writers do and how they destroy all the potential that they have,
see the beginning of this episode,
I'm more and more impressed with how good Ben McKenzie got over the years. Because I remember him in that thing that was DOC. I've seen maybe 5 or 6 episodes of that. I couldn't handle it. And then I remember him from Southland, which
that was a good show.
He was amazing in. It was a great show, and if I know it's not sci-fi, but if people really want to see Ben McKenzie show off every single emotion and his acting range, they should watch Southland. It's incredible. But here we get so much subtlety from him. I'm like, Ben McKenzie, I am impressed with you. Please stay on my screen as long as possible. You don't even need a mustache.
I think that Jim Gordon is knowing what a big hurdle he had all the way back in the beginning, how corrupt Gotham is and how corrupt the police department was. And so he's trying to be this pillar. And you saw it with Penguin when he's just like, no, I'm not going to do this. I shouldn't have done this. He's mad at himself for siding with Penguin, even when it got him the results that he needed, even when it was actually better than what most cops in Gotham had been doing before. You saw how upset he got with Barbara when he shared with her, and she ended up, you know, calling in that tip, and things got out of control. How things getting out of control are just not working for him. He wants to be this professional pillar. And as you start seeing things like at the, I'm going to jump from the end and then back to the beginning, when she says, you know, I have tickets to the circus, want to go? And you see how uncomfortable that is. I think part of that is because there's this part of him that's still tied to Barbara, and somehow they're trying to keep that story alive, trying to keep Barbara alive, although I think the Barbara story really is in a medically induced coma at this point. Really. You see that uncomfortableness. And I do, and I'm also still, I want Lee to have her moment with Alfred. I want that canon thing to appear in this, because I think that would be fabulous. But that uncomfortableness of like, oh my gosh, what have I gotten myself into? She was hot. We get along really well. We were having so much fun. Now she's here every day. I have to deal with you every day, whether it's at work or on the off time, and I don't know what to do. And you want to go to the circus? What's going on? And then you have him with Bullock more near the beginning, which this was a very easy episode for Donald, because, you know, he didn't have to do these major things, but he had some great lines with, you have no luck at all, brother. And then office romances always end in tears. Trust me, I know. I'm like, ooh, another little insight into Bullock. Something's happened with him, but he sees everything going on with Jim and how it's going to end, and it ain't going to end pretty.
Yeah. And I loved Bullock here, because he had such a heavy episode last week, right, in a way that, you know, that episode could be heavy, but Bullock had a lot of stuff last episode. And here you saw him back the way I think Jim sees him the most. This, you know, comfortable, laid back guy who is perfectly okay with mocking Jim at every point.
And he's taking it now.
Because that entertains him. Yeah. Now, we can save cases, but do not take my opportunities for sarcasm and mocking you away from me.
Well, what I like is,
I need them, like I need breathing.
What I like is, I think Jim and Bullock have now gotten to that point where in the beginning, when Bullock was acting like that, it was making Jim uncomfortable. He now has a new thing to make him uncomfortable. And being with Bullock now feels comfortable. Where it's like, yeah, go ahead and rib me. Okay, whatever. You know, they've got this great friend bond that is really coming out. And I think it helps bring them even more together. I love how they're playing off of each other. Okay. Talking about missed opportunities. Here we are, all happy, happy, joy, joy, and I'm going to go missed opportunities. Julian Sands. Such an awesome actor. And so little to do, even over two episodes. Let's talk about the crime at hand. We've been having people from the last episode that were being killed. We now know, because Bullock and Jim have gone and they figured out the whole crane link, and that one professor or headmaster or whatever who happened to know, was he targeting phobics? And here's the study he was doing, and they're looking at this, so they have kind of an idea now of what he's doing, that he's trying to overcome fear. Again, another good Ed moment. How I loved Ed, like, ooh, where was that? I didn't see that in the study. getting all giddy about that. We see that he's injecting himself to try and conquer his fear of being a failure, which stems from his wife dying in the house. Can I say, all those images of him seeing his wife, I just started thinking of Shutter Island. It's like total Leonardo DiCaprio moment with the flames and things. Like somebody stealing there. And kind of forcing this treatment on his son. Let's talk about our crime. Because, you know, this is supposed to be a cop show. So let's actually talk about the crime.
Okay. First of all, the plot point where wife, mother dies to give male characters pain and reason to suffer and do stuff is such an overplayed cliche. I am so over it. There are no words in the English language to describe how over I am.
Can I ask a quick question before you continue on that? If they flipped it and Dr. Crane was the wife and she saw her husband die, would it still be tired, or would it be okay since we're finally not sacrificing the woman for the story? Sorry.
Here's the thing. It would be okay because men dying for the female character's pain and character development is not a stereotype that we are used to in Hollywood.
Okay.
To the point where I gotta digress completely and not even too lost. To a point where when Angelina Jolie was starring in Salt, because she took over from Tom Cruise, which was so hilarious and awesome. In the first draft of the script, she was supposed to save her husband from whoever, I don't remember. Spoiler alert, the producers decided that it was better to kill the husband than to have her save him, because having a woman save a man would be emasculating. But his death added to her character development, and she went on this Aragorn-like rampage, killing everybody. That was awesome. So to answer your question, no, it wouldn't be overplayed, because we don't see it that often. Characters lose mothers, wives, daughters. They get taken away, put in the fridge. That's overplayed, and that's lazy writing. And you know how I hate lazy writing. I think I've mentioned it
once or twice.
Maybe. Possibly. Maybe. Possibly. So I had a huge problem with that. Like, seriously, yes, visuals of her walking down the stairs and the fire, visuals were amazing. But I'm not judging show.
But it's been done
alone.
Because it was Shutter Island, so. It's been done.
Yeah, but it was, oh, come on, let's come up with something original. The only reason they were doing those two episodes was because they wanted to do Scarecrow origin story. Like, Gotham is one big anthology of origin stories. And yet again, it's not the show we want to watch, but it's still the show that the writers want to write. So our expectations are
slightly different. I have to say that as we're kind of doing some origin stories, I like where we ended with it with Scarecrow, but I don't like that we did it. I mean, to me, it's like, why do we need to introduce it now? Why do we have to introduce everybody? And jumping ahead, spoiler, next episode looks like we're getting our Joker. Yay. You know, like, I'm not excited. It's, can we save somebody for second season, or are we just throwing everybody in now in? And go, see, we have to have a second season because we've introduced these 3 billion characters from DC Universe. So we have to do something with everybody that, you know, I don't like that we introduced Scarecrow, but I do like the end, those end images we had, with the sun. And actually the one good thing about the Julian Sands appearance was when he feels like he's conquered his fear, and the cops are coming after him, and he's injected his son with too much. Sometimes you do have to listen to the kids. It was too much. It was really too much, Dad. It was too much. But he is so confident. He has no fear. Mm. That's why he injected him with more, too much of that serum, because he has no fear about it doing anything to his son. Yeah. And he has no fear. So, of course, he stands up and starts shooting the cops and doesn't think, they're going to shoot back at me, and he ends up dying. It shows you really how important fear is. Fear is what saves our lives. Fear is what keeps us from doing those stupid things. And he lost his fear, and he did a stupid thing, two stupid things, with his son and with the cops. That made sense. Having him, you could have had anybody on. Why did you pay the money for Julian Sands for that?
Yeah. And another question. Didn't we really need two episodes? Like, seriously, wasn't there a way to put it all in one episode and make it action-packed and intense instead of drawing things
Actually, what I would have liked would have been it is a a thread that went through a lot of episodes and then had its one big episode. Instead of making it the supposed A story, but we know in Gotham they don't really know what A and B stories are, I'd rather have had it as a thread that you see some things. Maybe there's...
Yeah, one body showing up here and the second body showing up there.
So it's this case that's not getting solved and they don't have any clues and they don't have a lead. And then you have the bulk of it really boom in that one big episode. And I think that would make so much more impact. Now, I have to say I'm seeing that a lot in a lot of writing and shows in general where they're not doing even these 3-4 episode arcs as well. There's some shows that are doing it really well, but others have just lost it and they think, you know, a two-parter, that's what'll get everybody all riled up and excited about seeing the show, is doing a two-parter. This didn't feel like a two-parter. It had no reason to be a two-parter other than we see Julian Sands in the first one and we see Julian Sands in the second one, and it all has to deal with his son becoming Scarecrow.
Yeah.
But when his son became Scarecrow, that image was fabulous with him in the bed tied down and Jim out there and him seeing all these freaky scarecrows coming up over him. You know, I'm having all sorts of horror movie flashes. I'm seeing Family Blood from Doctor Who. I'm seeing all that, these kind of things. That's cool. And when he said, you know, like, imagine seeing the thing you fear most is all you see every waking hour. I'm like, okay, that's cool. Why did we have to get this now? But that's cool.
Yeah. Those final images were amazing. I gotta give you that. I'm impressed by the, I don't know, CGI department. I don't know who's responsible for that. But the visuals on that were amazing. But yeah. Either put it all in one explosive episode or spread the crumbs around and then have the, you know, like winter finale or some episode before a break.
Yeah.
That would leave us, you know, breathless and wanting more. That would be good and amazing and well done. Here is like, okay. It was a solid episode, but it wasn't as good as, you know, some other Gotham episodes and as good as it could have been. So,
I just wish it wasn't there. That just sounds so bad. I love some of the elements of it, but I really just wish it wasn't there. I will say, though, the actor that they have for the Scarecrow kid. I'm trying to quickly look it up because, of course, I didn't look it up ahead of time. I know. I'm sorry. He was really cool. I like how he played it. I like what he did with this. And
and
where I think he could go with this. Charlie Tahan? Charlie is his name. Charlie Tahan. T-A-H-A-N. Charlie.
Yeah, he was, in this episode, he was so much more impressive than last week with parking thing that he did, like, half a scene, basically.
But that's a good, was a good way to introduce him. If you had to introduce him, just look quick. Okay, we'll see him a little bit. Well, no, we'll see more of you later. We shouldn't introduce him yet.
So that was nice. But while we on Scarecrow and our, you know, never-ending litany of why do they introduce all those characters, I gotta make a connection to Arrow. Because
you haven't done one this episode.
Yeah, it's like I'm talking about Arrow every Gotham episode, podcast, but I really am feeling strongly about it. Because Gotham is the mess you get when DC allows you to play with all those characters from Batman, you know, and from that side of DC Comics. Because with Arrow, they weren't allowed to use anybody at the beginning. Like, they got, like, this tiny little limited amount of characters that they were allowed to play with. And they went with it. And what a success it was. In Gotham, the writers and powers that be got so many characters. It's like you have so many good things, you don't know what to play with, so you're like this kid in a sandbox, gathering all those toys next to you and not playing with them, but you have them close so nobody else can play with them.
Yeah.
It's just so messy. And so many.
I will say, like I said, I like how we eventually introduced this Scarecrow. I wish he hadn't been introduced now, and I wish we hadn't gone straight from that into next week we meet Joker. Ugh, Billy. You know, it's like...
Not to mention, I think it's next week that Jim and Lee go to the circus.
Yeah.
And meet the, you know, parents of Robin.
Yeah. So, these episodes, when you see, like, coming next week, you should be like, ooh! Like I was for the other show that we podcast on. I saw What Happens Next Week, and I'm like, oh, I can't wait at this. I was like, oh, really? Another one? We have to meet another supervillain to do an origin story? It's just, the story's tiresome. It's really getting tiresome. Okay, I want to move on. We got to move on. From all of this scaredy cat stuff, you know, people that are trying to overcome their fear. I want to move to somebody else, our final thing, who's overcoming his fears in his own ways, and he does not need to be injected with some goopy adrenal gland serum nasty crap from his dad. We have scenes here with Bruce and Alfred. And again, with our, you keep hearing us harp on this, if you have characters in there, have them for a reason. When we were trying to figure out the structure of how we want to talk about this, we're like, okay, Fish is really a standalone story and Bruce is really a standalone story. So maybe we talk about him first. And I'm like, you know what? Let's end with Bruce because he's Batman, for goodness sake. And this had nothing whatsoever to do with the story at all, but it was one of my favorite parts of the story. Besides Falcone. Besides, I'm Fish, Mooney, I'm in charge. I loved these scenes. I mean, you know, it's starting out with him telling Alfred, no, I'll go by myself. I got it. You know, you're wondering, first off, what is he going to do? And I'll be back before sunset. Well, usually you guys stayed overnight. That's okay. I'll be back before sunset. And he goes out on this trek that you realize he did with his dad. And this is the first time that he's not doing this with his dad. It was heartbreaking to see him, like Alfred so just wanted to be there for him and do something, but he knew he had to kind of stay back. And you're thinking, oh, okay, Alfred is just, he's just going to stay. I'll let Master Bruce go. Go ahead. What were your impressions about the beginning when we first saw?
Okay. I went through an entire spectrum of emotions when I was watching Bruce scenes and Bruce and Alfred, because I went from kind of indifferent, like, whatever, Bruce is going on a trek, yeah, okay, then realizing that this was something he did with his father. And so I realized how emotional, how important that was, even though it was completely disconnected from everything else that was happening in the episode. I didn't mind. Then when he started falling down the hill, I was half expecting him to land in a cave with lots of bats, because come on.
Bat cave, that's where I got the idea.
Yes. That was so out there, such a tongue-in-cheek possibility, that I was like, yes, please, please, go with the cave, go with the cave. He didn't go with the cave, but it was, you know, still nice. I know that this was more about Bruce and his healing, in a way, emotional, psychological healing, but I gotta tell you, Alfred stole those disconnected scenes completely.
Okay, let's not get there yet. Don't get there yet. We're so
fine. Fine.
Don't get there yet.
You go.
Did you know? Don't get to Alfred yet. No. Did you notice though, David, how this actor even looked at the beginning when we saw him? He looks like, I don't want to say he looks older. I don't want to say he looks more mature. He looks different than the Bruce that we've seen. He seems to have a different way that he's thinking, a different assuredness. Even his hair is a little bit different. The way he's holding his face, he looks like he's aged to me without really, I'm not talking, you know, a chronological age, but he looks like he's aged to me. And when he went out and you see him pick up the one rock and then he picks up the second one very thoughtfully. And then we see it's because there are these piles with those little rocks carved with their initials and he's adding to it. And then he just goes postal on his dad's pile. He is mad at his dad for leaving him because his father figure is gone. He destroyed his father figure right there and became very rash and walked off. And that's when he almost fell down into that. Yeah. I thought that in one of the commercials that maybe there had been a bat or something. So I had a flash too of like, are we going to see bats when he's falling down the thing? So I did think that too. Yeah. And we see him hurt himself. He really hurt his ankle, by the way. Man, they really made that look nasty. My one complaint was when we flash back to him, it's dark and he's done nothing. Absolutely nothing. You mean you sat there for however many hours and did nothing? You didn't do anything to your ankle. You didn't move. You didn't try to make a shelter. You didn't make yourself more warm. I'm like, you're not thinking. And then when he does start thinking and in the darkness decides, I got to get out of here. No one's coming for me. Because no one's coming for me. He doesn't have a dad anymore. Who would come for him? Who would possibly come for Bruce when he's out doing this?
Yeah.
Who would come for him, Alex?
This is...
Okay, now.
This is... Wait for it, because now I want to add something. Yes, I'm...
We're teasing.
Being very mature. I think, I have to defend the show. Wow. I know.
What?
Worldview shattered.
What?
But I'm going to defend the show in this one. Because I think, it's either an editing, misstep. I think, because what would make sense to me is, if he either lost consciousness for a second or for a while there, and then came to, and it was dark. That would make sense. You know, that he didn't do anything.
Not with what happens later.
But, from a character, but from a character point of view, I actually did think he expected Alfred to find him.
He expected help to come.
And that is why he didn't do anything. Cause that would make sense. If you know help is coming, what's the point of, you know, doing anything? Sit down.
Well, okay, I can see that, because here we've got the poor little rich kid.
Yeah, everybody did things for him, so how is he supposed to expect to, you know, not be
I like that idea. I don't think, if he had passed out and come to in the dark, then the next part doesn't make sense, because Alfred would have come down there and gotten him if he was passed out. But I think that that makes sense. He's sitting there, he's waiting for help because help always comes for him. Even if he doesn't think anybody is supposed to be coming for him, they're supposed to be coming for him. And he's sitting there. So it does make sense that when he finally does and he starts crawling up, Alfred saw the whole thing. Alfred saw him down there just sitting there conscious and is like, he's got to figure out for himself. He's got to do this for himself. And,
So
okay, that makes sense.
And when
I'll go with yours.
Crawled up and saw Alfred,
thanks for your help.
Yeah, I loved Alfred there because not only he kind of, you know, was there and was supportive of Bruce in a way. I loved his little nicknames because. I love
Master B. You mean
Master
the rapper?
B. Yeah, I cracked at that. I don't even know. But I loved when Alfred called Bruce Cheeky Monkey.
Hilarious.
Because it showed such a companionship, and you know, fine, we can stay and watch the sunrise if you want. If you have it in you to stay, you know, Bruce to Alfred, fine. If you think you can handle staying, we can stay. It was,
Our criticism that we've had, we love Sean, We love Sean Pertwee, and we've liked Alfred and Bruce, but Alfred's parenting skills have not been the greatest. But I think here, I think Alfred has finally found his rhythm, how he's supposed to help raise this kid. He's finally found his style, and that style is because he let Master Bruce go off into the woods on his own. This is after we had the assassin coming to the house, you know, not that long ago. I mean, long enough, but, you know, within 2 months ago. He's letting Bruce go off on his own, and he's realizing, I gotta let Master Bruce do what he does. And his line when Bruce comes up, it says, thanks for your help. And he said, I'm not the one who got you down there. So he's saying, I'm here for you. If you had been passed out, I would have been down there in a heartbeat. But you got yourself down there. You've got to get yourself back out. And I'm going to be up here with, you know, that cup of tea ready to support you and do whatever. But you're the one that's going to have to get yourself out of your messes. And you saw that moment where Bruce is that, I want to go home. And then he's like, okay. Or do you want to wait and watch the sunrise? Like with your dad. Alfred has now found that what he does, what he's best at, is helping to guide Bruce, but not really parent Bruce. And I saw that Alfred-Bruce relationship that I love from just about every incarnation of Batman, I saw the real true seeds of it right there. That is that unflinching
perfection of this Alfred friendship. Finally realized that what he's Chicken good monkey. At is letting Bruce learn his lessons, and then picking up the pieces if necessary, or giving him hot tea, or being the support person, not necessarily a parental figure, but that support safety net that Bruce can fall on after he has learned his lesson and twisted or sprained his ankle and could really use some hot tea.
I will say, Bruce needs to develop his bat hearing skills, because really, with all those leaves around, you didn't hear Alfred up there. I mean, you're not listening to like your iPod or something. You didn't hear Alfred up there making a fire, making some tea, crunching around in all those leaves. Come on.
Hey, let him grow up. Those he needs to learn skills. The lessons. Like, I don't know, go off to places and meet League of Assassins and all that. So, give him time. Let him grow up.
I really like how David and Sean work together. I think that is a really great partnership. And I'm really looking forward to the day when Dr. Tompkins goes, Jim who? When she meets
Alfred. Oh, you little shipper.
Alfred. I'm holding out for that. I'm so holding out for that. Okay, anything else? I think we covered everything.
It took us a while, but still, it was worth it.
You guys don't understand. It's been a long time since she and I talked, but it's actually only been how normally it should be. But when we last talked, we talked for 8 hours trying to catch up on 2 episodes of Gotham and 4 episodes of Sleepy Hollow. So it's been a long time. Our flow, our rhythm, was interrupted there a little bit, but we're friends, you know, and that's what happens because, you know, at least I've got my friends.
Fist bump.
Podcast with. Witness represent. Oh, wait, wrong podcast. Make sure to be our friend. Go and check us out on iTunes and subscribe to us there or the podcast platform of your choice. And of course, follow us on Twitter at Sci-Fi for Chicks. I did a lot of tweeting during the panels at the Dallas Comic-Con fan days. And thank you to everybody out there who followed along, retweeted, favorited, and responded back to me. Some really cool things. I mean, we didn't have anybody from Gotham at this Comic-Con, but Alex, come the May Dallas Comic-Con, we're going to be having Morena, and we're going to be having Robin Lord Taylor. So start thinking of any questions or anything out there that we want to try and see about getting up there. I can't guarantee that we'll get our questions up there to them, but definitely if you have any, let us know what it is and we'll try and get them out there at Comic-Con that is at the end of May. Don't forget also to go over to sci-fi4me.com and check out Jason's recap about this episode and see what the Stinky Boys think. Alex is keeping quiet on that one. And also check out Rogues Gallery, which is our scififorme.com podcast about the DC universe. And this is definitely part of that. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
We will see you next week when we get to meet the Joker. Mm. Yay.
Yay.
Can we contain our enthusiasm? Thank you so much for joining us. Bye-bye.
See you next week. Same bat time, same bat station.
This has been a presentation of SciFiForMe.com. Copyright 2015 by Flaming Dog Media, LLC. All rights reserved. No portion of this program may be retransmitted without the express written consent of Flaming Dog Media. This is Sci-Fi For Me Radio.